Good morning. It's your Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and Larry's back tomorrow. But Jesse LeGrew is back with us today. He's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, and he's here to answer any of your tech questions. I've got a few of my own today, but also we're looking at the burgeoning world of artificial intelligence. It seems to be everywhere all at once. If you were just listening to 1A, you heard the stories about not just surveillance pricing, but using AI and the data that has been gathered about us to use surveillance for wages as well, even rentals. Yeah, what AI can and can't do, we're still figuring it out, but it appears to be changing us as we are. So with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, today, if you have tech questions, everything from printers to cell phones to networks, routers, whatever you need, let Jesse know and we'll see if we can't help. You can get a hold of us right now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And Jesse, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Glad to be here.
So let's start with a little bit of AI, because I saw this new study. It's from MIT. There's some of the folks who would be on the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, and they seem to have found that AI is changing who we are, Jesse. Now, ChatGPT is this generative artificial intelligence chatbot. It was developed by OpenAI and released at the end of November 2022. It is less than 3 years old already, but some suggestions, including this MIT study, Jesse, seem to imply that ChatGPT and other AI chatbots are changing the way we think.
Yeah, and at least with this study, which has not been completely peer-reviewed and published yet, at least some information was published really just to get people thinking about how a lot of these large language models, or LLMs, as we call them, such as ChatGPT and many of the other variants out there, how they might impact really how we go about decision-making, how we go about problem-solving, specifically how we go about critical thinking, and how does the use of these tools impact, in this case, the study was how our brain interacts with the information, how we go about generating content, whether it might be written content, papers, or other information, and how that differs between using a tool and not using a tool. And it was really interesting in this case to at least see some of the preliminary information from a very small sample size that the use of these tools could impact really how engaged we might be with the material we're creating, in addition to maybe even some of the motivation behind kind of what we're doing. So it was really interesting to think about, you know, if we use large language models, ChatGPT, whatever tool might be out there, are we really thinking about things the same way? And how does that change how we go about problem solving, just other day-to-day things in our lives?
So the lead author of this MIT study says they wanted to look at the impact of students using AI to write some essays. And then English teachers, as I understand it, Jesse, assessed the essays. What did they find? How did they describe them?
I think the frame they actually used was, quote unquote, soulless.
Oh.
that a lot of the information really didn't have a lot of substance behind it. I think one of the other interesting things with some of the papers, and I don't know if the details for each of these papers were also released, but the information also tended to be pretty similar. So if you're going to ask a large language model a question, you ask the same question 10 times, some of those responses are going to be different, but they might hold a similar theme. So if somebody is using a lot of these large language models to generate content, it might also show that a lot of the information becomes very, very similar. Mm-hmm. There's not a whole lot of differences in thoughts and ideas, which otherwise could be generated by the user. And I think that was one of the items that came out is the information. It was information, but it wasn't really rooted in, I guess, a thoughtful process of somebody generating ideas to ask questions about it, to be curious about the content. It was really kind of a generation from the large language models that the information may have been useful, but the inquisitive nature of a person to ask questions and maybe go in a different direction that could show a little bit more interest just didn't happen when using these large language models.
It's just got no soul. So this, the MIT team that did this research found also, again, preliminary, not peer reviewed yet, but wanted to put this out there to see what sort of how this reverberates. ChatGPT users reportedly got lazier and relied more on the AI to write their essays as they went forward. What do you see, Jesse, as some of the implications for learning as AI becomes more and more ubiquitous?
I think it really does require us to think about how we're using the tools and if we're using them effectively. One of the items they did point out in the study as well is, you know, they had different groups using these tools. One, that was the first way they tried to create a paper, but they also had individuals trying to create papers without the use of these tools, and then later trying to use those tools to improve maybe what they wrote so far or to write some new content. And the order in which those tools were placed, whether it was before writing anything or after writing something, seemed to change at least the brain activity for those individuals in the study. So using it in the right way at the right time could be a good benefit. I think one thing that I've noticed, I like to use generative AI for brainstorming. If for whatever reason I might feel stuck in a certain area, I might try to generate new ideas and to, get myself out of my own bubble, because that can be a little bit challenging sometimes. But I found if I'm, whether I'm doing it for something written or let's say I'm generating code, the generating code is, I found that a little bit more interesting in terms of I'll use it to generate some kind of information I'm using for a specific task. And I tend to do that more and more often. All of a sudden, I'm not actually thinking about the code I'm generating. I'm not trying to create it myself. I'm not learning through the process of a little bit more trial and error. I'm actually going to a tool and doing what they might call vibe coding, just trying to generate and update tools as you see fit. The process for me is, I mean, I'm not thinking about it. I'm not processing it. I'm not trying to understand what I could do better to actually generate this code. I'm relying on a tool to do it. And I think that's really challenging because, one, I know I'm not learning. Maybe I have a tool in the end that does function. I might know enough to troubleshoot it if I need to. But the more and more that happens, the more difficult it is to kind of maintain that over time. If I did that for years and stopped generating any kind of content myself, I actually might lose the ability to troubleshoot that effectively. So over time, some of that knowledge gets lost. The ability to think about that in a different way becomes a lot more challenging. And so I think that's one thing I notice in myself when using these tools that seem to also be a factor in the study, where if you're using it a lot and you're not doing anything else, that ability to go back and to start from scratch, to not have the tool as something you can use to generate content, it becomes a lot more challenging. It takes a lot longer, and the content just isn't as good.
Jesse, before we get to the calls, I want to test this MIT study a little bit, push back on it a little bit, because it seems to be, at least from my perspective, some of the same arguments we heard when, and I'm old enough to say this now, people wanted calculators in math classes. Well, if calculators are in the math class, you don't have to do math. The machine does it for you. When computers became a part of education and how computers were seen as a shortcut to thinking. But what we've seen over time is that may be the case in some of the simple strategies and some of the simple tasks, but it also allows our brain to do more complex things or move beyond the simple math to something a little more complicated. Is that a possibility moving forward with AI? And does it depend on how we use it going forward?
I definitely think it is something to think about. I think with, any tool, we're going to be using it in different ways. There's going to be a concern with any new tool just in terms of whether it's being used in a good way. So are we using it for good things or are we using it for malicious purposes? But also, what's happening to our own skills? Do they atrophy? Do they get less effective over time? I do think it allows us to choose a little bit more in terms of what we're thinking about. And so that is a benefit of these tools, but I also think there are ways we can think about how to use it that will allow us to get the best benefit using the tools, in addition to kind of maintaining our own capabilities to do some of the tasks. And part of it isn't necessarily whether AI is good or bad. Maybe some things we just don't need to learn anymore, but there might be a time, and this is always something we'd like to talk about in cybersecurity or IT in general, when things fail, what happens, right? So let's say you don't have AI available for you today for whatever reason. Maybe there's a power outage, maybe the service is just unavailable. If you do need to perform some kind of tasks when it's not there, what do you do? And so I do think that's something we do need to consider really with any technology, and AI is just a new tool in that ecosphere of when it's not available, what do we do? How do you think through the problem? If the calculator doesn't work or you just don't have it available, what do you need to do if you need to do it longhand? Maybe you don't need to do it longhand, but it's a good process to think about of when things fail, how do we go about addressing that situation?
Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer for Madison College, taking your questions on our Tech Update Monday on The Larry Mueller Show at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Sheila in Eau Claire, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you have for
Hello.
Us?
Good morning. My question is about Microsoft 10. The protection is supposed to expire in October. And what can we do if we do not want to buy a new desktop that has Microsoft 11 on it?
Is your Microsoft sent you a thing saying that you're unable to upgrade to Windows 11 because of your operating system or hardware, Sheila?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet, anyway.
So you've got an older computer running Microsoft 10, and the support's going to end in October. Jesse, what can she do to stay safe online and using this PC?
Yeah, there are a couple options. So a lot of individuals who do have devices that can run Windows 11, you might have the capability to upgrade for free. If the device just, for whatever reason, doesn't have enough power to run Windows 11, there are not a whole lot of options in terms of keeping the software up to date to make sure that you're getting security updates or any of the other updates you might need in a day-to-day basis. And that's kind of a challenge, not just with Microsoft, but with really any provider of computers, is at some point the hardware just won't be capable of running the latest operating system. And if you can't run Windows 11 and take advantage of that free upgrade, the best path, which is what Microsoft is going to recommend, is likely to replace your computer to a device that can actually run Windows 11, which you can get from a variety of, you know, different locations that sell devices. There is a PC upgrade check utility on Windows 10. So if you go to the Start menu and Settings, there's an Update and Security tab, and you can click on Windows Update to see if there are any updates. It should give you either an option to upgrade to a Windows 11, or maybe it will not. If you do not get that Windows 11 upgrade option, you can also go to Microsoft's website. They do have some other checking utilities, but usually that's going to be the first place I'm going to go just to see if you can upgrade to Windows 11. And if you're able to do it, it usually takes a little bit of time. I've only done it a few times on at least some of my personal devices. Mm-hmm. We're going through that right now with a lot of devices at the college as well. Mm-hmm. I haven't had a lot of big issues with Windows 11 and programs not working unless they were really, really, really old. I think it's probably been the smoothest upgrade I've had in, I'd probably say, the last 20 years in terms of Windows upgrades. So the upgrade itself isn't too bad. It just depends on whether your hardware is powerful enough to run it. And the downside is if it's not powerful enough to run it, the only real option you have is either running Windows 10 that is going to have security patches it can't install, which means you might be vulnerable, or at least more vulnerable to software doing something bad. It could be viruses or other items. So I'd usually recommend try to get the latest version, which might mean getting a new device. It may also be not getting a Windows device. So Windows devices, you know, if you have to buy a new device, it's always the good time to think, well, do I want to run Windows, right? What do I need in a day-to-day basis to do the things I need to do? If it's web browsing, email, things that can be done from a web browser, you know, a Chromebook could be a good option. You can also run a Mac. There are a lot of other good things to think about in terms of what device do you need. Mm-hmm. So if you really do have that decision where you need to replace it, you actually might want to go into a store and think about different options outside of Windows that could also give you what you need for really less cost. A lot of the larger operating systems may require a little bit more resources. And there's a lot of good options out there, including Chromebooks for, you know, basic casual computer use.
And when you talk about getting a new device, Jesse, and, you know, people need to connect to the internet, but people don't always have the means to get a new PC or new computer. What's your feelings about refurbished computers and how affordable, effective they are? Would you advise against it? Is that something that could be as good as new, or is it a crapshoot?
It's hard to know. So do I recommend using refurbished computers? I'd say it's a great option. I've done it myself many, many times, both for testing devices or just to be able to test something out or use something for a much lower cost. One of the challenges with refurbished devices, depending on where you get it from, is usually you're going to have a shorter warranty period. Mm. That warranty period might be 0 days. It might be 30 days. It might be 90 days. Maybe you can get one that's even longer, but that's usually going to be the biggest challenge, is how long do you have support if something breaks?
Yeah.
And usually it's going to be about the hardware itself. So, you know, if you're running a refurbished device, maybe it's been in use for a year, maybe it's been in use for a day. but, you know, the more you use something, generally, you know, the life cycle starts counting down. Mm-hmm. Eventually, all things fail. It's just a matter of time. And you could get really lucky and it will never fail, or you could have bad luck and it could fail after a day. It's hard to know. So if you do get a refurbished device, I would just check on how long can I get hardware support if something breaks. And if you get a year, generally that tends to be the default, even for some new devices. A lot of them will have 2 to 3 years. But if you're able to get good support for the hardware, at least for a year, I'd feel a lot more comfortable doing it. Otherwise, you know, if it breaks, you're kind of in that situation where now you might have to pay to fix it. Granted, if it's a very inexpensive device, it may not be that much of an issue,
right?
Because replacing the device actually with another refurbished device may be cheaper than fixing it. So all of those kind of come into play, but I would check on hardware warranties and service for any refurbished device specifically.
Insight into the mind of a chief information security officer. I believe I'm quoting you, Jesse, when I say all things fail, it's just a matter of time. I'm going to take that with me. That's maybe a life lesson from our guest, Chief Information Security Officer from Madison College, Jesse LeGrew, who's helping to answer your tech questions today at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or bounce us a quick email to talk@WPR.org. What questions do you have about your gear, hardware, software, and networking it all together? 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Coming up at noon today on WPR News, The Larry Mueller Show talks about a new PBS Wisconsin series called Welcome Poets. It's with former Wisconsin Poet Laureate Nicholas Gulick, and he joins us next hour, along with PBS Wisconsin producer Colin Crowley. And then at 12:30, we look back at 45 years of the Madison-based Rainbow Project and what children need today to help with their mental health. We'll take a look at what is best practices for our kids and help answer your questions. But right now with Jesse LeGrew, we're answering your tech questions on our Tech Update Monday at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. From your printer to artificial intelligence, you let us know what we can do to help you today. And we'll go to Jason in Green Bay next. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. I had a comment about artificial intelligence and the way it's being used. I've used it quite a bit, and I often find that when I ask a question, the first answer isn't really what you want.
Hmm.
What I've developed is more of an iterative process where you define the problem and step by step refine it. And I think I get better results that way.
Jason, can I ask which AI tool you use? Is it through Gemini, through Google? Is it Claude? And I think Open ChatGPT is the other one. From
mm-hmm.
Which ones do you use and like?
I usually use Gemini or Copilot.
And you're actually engaging with it and refining as you go along. So when you get an answer that's not quite to your liking, you tell it that?
Yep. Well, I make sure to define my problem first.
Jason.
Do it as a step-by-step process.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Jesse, and it sounds a little bit like how you use AI.
Yeah, and it's a great way to use AI. Part of it, as noted, is kind of framing the question or the problem. So there's a few different ways to do it. One, you can kind of write pages before you hit enter and make that first question as detailed as possible. That can be really, really challenging. It tends to be a little bit more, you know, cost effective to go through that iterative process. So kind of outline the problem or the question that you have. If you do have constraints such as, you know, don't think about this, do think about this, and then go through the process of really kind of more having a conversation and going through that iterative process is a really good idea, because it does really help to, you know, what you're really doing is scoping the problem and scoping the question to give it an idea of when it's on the right track, when it's on maybe the wrong track, giving examples to kind of clarify the outcomes it's giving. I think a lot of that can be really, really good. One item that I always think about, depending on the tool I'm using, is, you know, if you're logged into a tool, the prompting can be really, really great to get an answer for one problem. One challenge I've also found is if you are logged in and have a paid subscription to a tool, it may remember too much, including the previous questions and everything else that you've given it. And so it starts building a profile around you. Sometimes that can be really useful when you want to use it for a lot of kind of long-term items that might relate to each other. But when you want to make sure to have kind of a brand new conversation, sometimes it can be really useful to say, hey, forget about everything I told you before. And we'd like to start off scratch and then ask the question. So definitely that iteration is important. I think that profiling that a lot of the tools use is also useful. But sometimes you might need to tell it, hey, let's start from scratch. Pretend, you know, I never told you any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's kind of go from the very start and then ask a new question. But it does help with that process, and it can help, you know, generate better prompts in the future, too.
And so what you put into this has a lot to do with what you're going to get out of it, and whether you're ultimately specific or you go refining your requests from these chatbots, that you play a pretty central role in what the outcome is and what kind of output you get from it.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Well, thanks for the call, Jason, and I appreciate your perspective. And Jesse, what is there specific chatbots that you use for specific reasons right now? What do you tend towards?
There are. I probably don't dabble in too many of them. A lot of individuals I know are playing with a lot of the more kind of more deep learning modules that require a lot more higher paid subscriptions. Mm. But it does require time to actually let the AI tool process and generate the information. And most of the most of the prompting tools I use for small problems or for brainstorming. So I tend to use ChatGPT and Microsoft Copilot a lot, which is also based on OpenAI's ChatGPT. Huh. I haven't used a whole lot of Claude or Gemini or a lot of the other tools, mainly because I haven't had to. I tend to give it really, really tiny, small problems.
Sure.
But I have seen differences if I'm asking for, let's say, Python code. And that I could explore some different tools for that. So I have seen just differences based upon what the tools are trained on, whether they have access to internet repositories. You do get different responses based on the tool. So I think for anyone thinking about, you know, what tool's the best for me, it might be half a dozen tools. It just depends on the situation.
have a follow-up to an earlier call from Sheila, who was concerned about Microsoft support for her operating system, Windows 10, which is set to expire next month. Got an email from Karen, who said they got a, have a computer running Windows 10 about 8 years old now, and Karen gets pop-up messages that the Windows 10 will no longer be supported after October 14th. Karen says she ran a PC health check to see if the computer would support a free upgrade to Windows 11, and it will not. Their current computer processor will not allow it. It's not fast enough or good enough or whatever it is in there. Karen wants to know if they need to get a new computer or can they have a new processor installed inside their motherboard on their PC right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's likely that a processor upgrade will not be an option and that the hardware will need to be replaced. And the main reason is for a lot of the processors out there, they do require a specific kind of motherboard or the support needs to be there. So it's kind of a hardware problem where we could get the newest processor, but the other components of the laptop just wouldn't be compatible with it.
So hold on, Jesse, walk me through this now. When we talk about a processor and we talk about a motherboard, what are these pieces of hardware doing inside our computer for us?
Yeah, and so a computer is basically just, and it's hard to know unless you've actually seen one,
right?
It's a grouping of a lot of other electronics. Some can be replaced, some can be upgraded, some can't. Depending on the device, you may have options to upgrade, and on others, you may not. Two of the items that most people talk about when thinking about like upgrading components, processors is one of them, but usually it's going to be hard drives or memory, otherwise known as RAM. The RAM is where programs are running from, and your hard drive is usually what stores all of your data, and it stores the programs that are running. So it's where all your information is stored. A lot of those you can usually upgrade pretty easily. All of these pieces usually plug into the motherboard, which is the central component that everything else plugs into and allows all these different devices, including your monitor, keyboard, and mouse, to all talk to each other. And the processor, which is what does all the thinking, gives you all of the output and processes all this information that plugs into the motherboard and coordinates a lot of what your computer is doing. And unfortunately with, and it's hard to, and you might've seen it with, you know, if we want to look at an analogy that's at least computer related, if anyone's had an iPhone, they've had a lot of chargers over the years, a lot of different headphone cables that, right, you know, you might need to use for audio. And sometimes when components are upgraded, the old devices just don't work anymore. You can't plug it in. Sometimes there's an adapter for it, sometimes there's not. With a motherboard and a processor, generally there's no adapters. You either, it either can work with it or it can't. And in this case, it's not as easy just to upgrade the processor. You kind of have to upgrade everything along with it because that motherboard is so, is that central piece that ties it all together. So, which really leads down the path of, you kind of need a new computer.
Yeah.
It's very likely you can't just upgrade that one piece. You have to upgrade another piece, which then you have to upgrade another piece. And it just, it's a set of dominoes that goes, and all of a sudden, you know, you just need to buy that new computer because there's no way to replace one component without replacing everything.
Whether it's the whole unit or piece by piece, you're getting a new one either way. Sorry to say, Karen, or a refurbished one if you prefer. Jesse LeGru, our guest, Chief Information Security Officer for Madison College on this Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show, answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Jack in Madison, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I have a question. I hope Jesse could address not a real specific question, but it's regarding an Android app that's been rolled out by Google called Find Hub. I got notification last week that they were going to roll it out, and I had 2 days to opt out. And I got notification yesterday that it had been rolled out, and I didn't opt out. So I'm wondering what you could tell me about that particular app, what their intent is, and do people really lose stuff so much that this is a new geolocating app that they're making integral to their to their phone.
Well, it sounds almost like AirTags from Apple, Jesse. That this is a way to compete with Apple for some of the products they have. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's definitely what it sounds like from kind of the description. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for a lot of people that use Apple devices or non-Apple devices, because you can actually get these AirTags to work pretty much just about anywhere, but you need some kind of iOS device, whether it's an iPad or an iPhone, to make it work. People do lose things quite a bit. And I think one of the items that the Google Atmosphere didn't really have, at least for a product themselves, was something like these AirTags that we can get from Apple. There are a lot of third-party products that you can actually purchase that do the same thing and that do work with Google devices, Android devices, and other items. But I think Google wanted to basically have their own option to do the same thing. So they wanted something built into their devices where they could potentially use other hardware and allow you to find your device or find other items. We've all had kind of the find your phone that we've seen on Apple devices. Mm-hmm. And there's been something similar usually on Google devices as well. But it is an option to kind of geolocate your device.
Bigger question here, Jesse, and it has to do with, you know, Jack didn't opt out in time. All of a sudden, he's got new software that he's finding on his device that he doesn't want and would rather live without. What happens when you get to the point where all of a sudden you were finding maybe software added on or new features or apps that you don't want there, and what can you do about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in this case, for the Find Hub, it should be able to be uninstalled in a couple different ways. So if you go to settings and then apps and all apps, you can actually click on Find Hub and do uninstall if you actually have it on your device itself. So if you're looking through the pages of icons on your screen, you should be able to kind of push your finger against it and keep it pushed for a little bit of while, and it'll usually give you a menu and one of those options will be uninstall. So you should be able to uninstall it if you need to, and you should be able to do this with any other application.
Yeah.
So one of the big challenges is, what about these other apps that keep on getting installed? Can I just stop from having these items uninstalled? Yes and no. One of the challenges is manufacturers and software developers will constantly change their products. And so even if today you have an option to don't do this in the future without my consent, in the future it could change. unfortunately, a lot of the responsibility is put on the owner of the device to keep updated and to change these settings. That being said, that's why a lot of people actually do uninstall. They actually will install their own operating system on a Google device or a different device specifically. The challenge is then you have to maintain that yourself. You have to have a certain level of technical knowledge. You have to install apps in a completely different way potentially. And so it gets really, really complicated. So there are ways to kind of move outside of the, let's say, Apple or Google atmosphere, but it requires a lot of work. It requires knowledge and it requires time, which a lot of people generally can't do. For me, I just tend to look at, usually I'll go in for Google devices, go into the Google Play Store. They will have options where you can list the apps. It will also give you some options to uninstall from there or to choose how it automatically updates your applications as well. So I tend to take a look at those settings quite a bit, or the settings under the phone itself. That being said, those settings can change. And so I think that's the biggest challenge. Is when you have a big phone update where it asks you, hey, by the way, reinstall or restart to install the latest update, that could be one of those times where some of those settings get changed. And so it's kind of a personal note of, if that happens, you might want to check those settings to make sure they're still turned off. But you should be able to uninstall them in the future if you don't want them. That can be trickier depending on kind of the phone you have. Some providers will also have their own applications that are installed that, you know, may need to be on there, or you can't uninstall just depending on the settings for the phone. So you still have some control to uninstall things, but you might find for different applications, for different cell phone providers, some of those options could be different depending on the applications they might require installed for troubleshooting or for other account management options.
It's our Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. Our guest, Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer for Madison College, answering your tech questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. You're listening to the Larry Mueller Show on WPR News, and Larry's back tomorrow, and he'll have a guided tour of our gastrointestinal system. Interesting. A cure for mending a broken heart. Even more interesting. And the author of the new book, Time, Beauty, and Grief, A Hike Through Wisconsin's 50 State Parks. Don't miss the Larry Mueller Show tomorrow with Larry Mueller from 11 to 1. Right now, I'm Lee Rayburn with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, for your Tech Update Monday. Jesse is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. And we're taking your questions about what and answering how we can help with your tech questions, whether it's AI or just a printer that will not connect. We'll go to Corey and Judah next. Corey, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about putting a resume together in a way that's compatible with the various online formats, particularly so it's searchable by AI.
Mm-hmm. I have heard this, Corey, and I'm glad you asked it. For those who are job hunting out there, they have a new, I guess, gauntlet to go through with artificial intelligence trolling through some of the resumes and looking for keywords. How can Corey build a resume using AI in a way that AI will recognize, Jesse?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And there's been a lot of people that have also tried to use the AI reading tools to kind of cheat the system a little bit. One thing I usually recommend for anyone kind of creating a resume at all really is to get, you know, plenty of feedback in terms of creating it. Also to actually feed it into different AI systems if you have them.
Hmm.
I usually recommend doing this if you have a subscription where, because generally for most AI tools that are used out there, unless you have a subscription, you know, the information might be public. So if you do have your phone number, your address, information that otherwise you may not want to have publicly accessible, you know, you might have challenges just throwing it into ChatGPT. Well, it'll let you, but I would recommend trying to have a plan where, you know, that information couldn't be discovered by others, and actually see what information it finds really from the resume to see if it matches with the qualifications or the information put up for a job posting. That can be one way to at least see how an AI tool will read it, how it'll consume it, and how it will determine, you know, whether based upon that job posting, whether the resume given kind of addresses the things that might come up. That being said, you know, I probably wouldn't recommend doing this, but one thing that somebody had also noted is a lot of the tools, you know, read not just what us people see on a normal resume. So, you know, might have a 2 or 3 page resume, you might have a cover letter that goes along with it. As individuals, we're just reading that content from top to bottom and trying to understand what's being reflected there.
But
an AI tool will read everything, including if it's stuff that's not visually accessible.
Metadata.
Metadata. If you also have, let's say, text that's white on a white background, as a person, I wouldn't see it, but an AI tool will. And I think that was one of the examples that I had seen somewhere else where it could actually be used to add information, even if a normal person couldn't see it. So I think those were strategies people were trying to kind of trick the AI into reading more information that a person wouldn't. But I would recommend, you know, crafting something, putting it through an AI tool to understand how the information is going to be processed and how it matches that data. One thing I'm not sure about, and I haven't looked through a lot of postings recently, it could be really useful to know what specific tool the individual or company posting the job is going to be using.
Yeah.
partially because it could give you a good indication of what tool to test with. And you can probably find other recommendations online in terms of, you know, how to draft a resume specifically with this tool. I think a lot of the tools are usually going to work pretty similarly, but a company might, you know, heavily modify it based upon how they draft their own job profiles and how they like to receive their resumes. So just having a little bit of information in the background of that company can be really helpful, but I do recommend, you know, try to find a tool, you know, take out maybe your personal information, but give it, you know, the rest of your resume and see what it might give you in terms of, you know, kind of a pass fail grade in terms of, do I meet the qualifications? How does this potentially match with other candidates? So
kind of takes me back to where we started, Jesse, with that MIT study and finding that AI responses came back, in their words, soulless. That how do you show that you've got some soul in a world where everything seems to be automated and AIs are talking to AIs? How do you get yourself heard?
Yeah, and it's, and you know, that's a really hard question, especially considering there's a lot of different job resources out there that can automatically apply to jobs for you. So what that means, it's a great item for people looking for a job. One of the challenges is it means that it's not just 10 or 20 people applying for a job. It might be hundreds or thousands.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these items are being automatically submitted. And it just drowns out a lot of the information that's being made available to employers. And so they have to find ways to kind of filter out that information to find out, well, how are we going to vet this? And that's probably one of the reasons for using these AI tools, is because of that large volume, but to also save time in terms of how to process it and pick out those best candidates. I even remember, I think one of the first resumes I created, it was actually with a company that was using computer processing, and this was like 20, 25 years ago. It wasn't necessarily AI, but it was probably built on keywords, and they wanted a plain text format. They wanted nothing fancy, no pictures, no changes in font, because they wanted to feed this plain text really into a computer program that would give them an indication of whether you had the skills based upon the information that you put down. It's probably what I'd still recommend in this case for any kind of tool that AI is going to be reading. Most of these tools are going to be able to be reading documents that have specialized formatting, but some might have challenges with it. And that's where at least finding a tool that you can test with to get feedback from, I think, is going to be an important part of the process, because it at least gives you some confidence that it's reading the information properly. It either could or could not find the information according to what they had in the position description, and it gives you a better idea of how you can update it. And just like the comments earlier about iterating and asking more questions, you can iterate that resume, make updates, feed it back, see what additional feedback you get, so you can make it as, you know, as good as possible for whatever tool that the company might be using.
Hey, Jesse, here's a follow-up email about AI. Russell in Madison wants to know if they tell an AI tool something it didn't already know, will it learn that for the benefit of others, or does it forget it as it go on, or does it depend on which AI large language model you're using?
Usually it depends on the AI model.
Okay.
And it also depends on the subscription. So usually this goes back to the thing it's really hard to do because you'd have to read so much. The terms of service usually is going to tell you how the information supplied to that tool will use. For most of the free tools where you don't have to sign in or you don't have to pay any money, most of that information is going to be used for learning of that large language model.
Goes back to the online idea that if you're not paying for a product, you are the product.
Right. And the other challenge with that is what it might be learning might also not be great stuff, right? It could be inaccurate. It could just be problematic in a variety of different ways. And so that's also one of the things to think about when using any kind of AI tool is, you know, we may still need to validate the information to better understand, is the information actually factual? Is it correct?
Yeah.
You know, using different tools, doing research yourself can also help with that. But I think that also, you know, goes to kind of weighing what you're using it for, what level of confidence do you need for the tool? Because in the end, to even validate some of that information means, well, you have to do some work, which, you know, was it then beneficial to use the tool if you have to go back and do all this work to begin with? So those are, you know, constant challenges. I think we had that issue with Google, even without artificial intelligence. So that same challenge presents itself.
Jesse, when we talked last time about artificial intelligence, you told me that you were more concerned about AI being used for malicious ways online to target, I think it was scams would be the best way to describe it, more so than you were concerned about AI taking over the world and enslaving the human race. How might somebody who's just online see AI being used, and we've only got a few minutes left here, against them or in attempts to scam them?
It's going to be a lot of the same kinds of attacks we've seen, but being done with an AI tool, and you might not even see it. So it could be a phishing email. It could be a scam text. A lot of the different AI tools out there don't just create like, hey, give me a good scam email where I can have somebody click on a link and give me information. It can actually be a little bit more detailed than that, where you can have what they call like an agentic AI making decisions and taking actions based upon input. So you can actually have an AI bot chatting with a person over SMS, text message, and gathering information or trying to get data in different ways. So the scams that required a lot of people time may not require the same amount of people time now and can be even more successful because they're able to take time to try and get information from individuals that, you know, you just may not have the capability to do otherwise without somebody sitting at a keyboard 24/7. So I think that's, you know, going to be a continuing challenge, is those same scams that we've been seeing for a very, very long time are going to be much easier to distribute.
Yeah.
And they could also be a bit more personal, where it can look up information online about you and get data that it can customize those attacks a lot easier than what have been done in the past.
So no new scams under the sun. It's just the magnitude and scope that AI can, you know, basically give steroids to. The AI company Anthropic released its monthly threat intelligence report, and it says their own AI called Claude is being misused to conduct, quote, a large-scale extortion operation. Seems to go to the heart of what you were talking about with us last time, Jesse.
Yeah, and that the misuse of tools, once again, it's something we've seen forever with any tool, and it's going to be, you know, even more challenging with a lot of large language models and other AI tools coming out here in the future.
Last question I have for you comes from Ken in Little Chute today, and it has to do with Windows 10 sunsetting here in October. Ken emailed to ask, what's the danger in continuing to use a Windows 10 computer after Microsoft support ends? Will the McAfee virus program protect Ken's computer, Jesse?
Yeah, so the risks are, you know, you may not get security updates that might have, you know, vulnerabilities which people can take advantage of. I'd say McAfee or any other anti-malware or protection suite can only help you so much. None of them protect 100% for all attacks.
There you go.
And so I think it can protect to an extent, but it's not going to be bulletproof, even with full updates and McAfee and whatever other tools. Nothing's 100% in terms of protecting your equipment.
I do believe the quote from you is, all things fail, it's just a matter of time. Jesse LeGrew. There you go. Hey, thanks as always, Jesse. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. And when we continue after the news, we welcome poets with a new PBS Wisconsin series and a recent Wisconsin Poet Laureate, Nick Gulig. Also, we'll take a look at the Rainbow Project in the next hour, so don't go anywhere. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.